States versus Noble. Mr. Griffith.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Robert Griffith, and I represent the appellant John Noble. Today, this case makes its third appearance before this court. Both sentences previously, both times we were previously before this court, resulted in this court vacating the sentence imposed by the trial court. First time based on an Apprendi violation, the second time based on this court's finding that certain drug quantities contained in Mr. Noble's relevant conduct calculation, which added as much as 10.5 years to Mr. Noble's sentence, were not in fact supported by sufficient evidence. Accordingly, this court reversed and remanded. The relatively narrow sentencing question posed in this case results in what happened at that remand. Specifically, the question presented in this case is where this court on appeal finds that relevant conduct and drug quantities, which the government plainly had the burden of proof on, are not supported by sufficient evidence, is the government entitled on remand to a second effort to introduce new evidence in a belated effort to patch the holes that this court found in his case?
Now, you argue that the government should only be given one opportunity to present that evidence on the issue of relevant conduct, meaning the government should only have one bite at the apple. Essentially, that's your position.
Exactly.
So would your stance apply to a defendant attempting to augment a record on remand?
I think the
in other words, the flip situation.
I think the situation would be the same, depending on if it's a an issue where the defendant had a burden of proof on, then certainly he would not be presented to a second chance to present any evidence on that issue. Now,
is your argument a double jeopardy argument or? Because it sounds a little like, you know, of course, if a conviction is reversed because of insufficient evidence, the government, as opposed to trial error, the government is not allowed to go back and try the person again and put in additional evidence. Is that the sort of thing, or you don't mention double jeopardy, but what is the basis for this rule you're propounding that the government shouldn't get the opportunity to present additional evidence?
The basis for this, we do argue in an alternative fashion that double jeopardy principles do apply. However, the Supreme Court nor the Seventh Circuit has extended the double jeopardy principles to a non-capital offense sentencing question. But the same principles apply, and the basis for that position is this court's decision in United States versus Wiss, actually a decision penned by the chair of this honorable panel. And the Wiss holds that when a defendant is sentenced based on uncharged drug-related misconduct, it's the government's burden of proof on that issue. And where the government on appeal is found to not have carried that burden, it is not permitted a second chance at carrying that burden.
So you're not arguing that the government should never be allowed to augment the record on appeal, are you? You're just saying when the government has the burden in the scenario you just described?
That is correct. There are certain limited circumstances where the government could be theoretically permitted to augment the record. And one of those examples is this court's decision in United States versus Sumner. In that case, the court found that the relevant conduct in question had not been challenged by the defendant, had not been objected to at the original sentencing hearing, i.e. it was forfeited.
Isn't that the position taken by the government in this case?
That was the position taken by the government in this case in the original appeal, and this court rejected it.
Yeah.
The government argued that we forfeited that issue. We pointed the court to all the arguments raised at every step of the way, and this court agreed and found that Mr. Noble had objected to the sufficiency of the evidence of the Job quantity at every level. There was no forfeiture. There was no waiver.
Well, so in a situation where the defendant failed to object to the sentencing issue below, and we reviewed it then on plain error, you would say the government would have the right to augment the record.
I think depending on the circumstances, certainly.
Right. I know you're not saying it for all. I'm just trying to get to what kind of rule we should adopt and sort of the limitations on that rule.
I think that is correct based on this court's decision in the United States versus Sumner, which carved out that narrow, limited exception to the Wish rule as also promulgated by this court.
What about a situation where the district court had to choose between two enhancements because they involve the same relevant conduct, and on appeal, the court rejects the chosen enhancement that the court relied on? Would the government be able to present more evidence on remand concerning the alternative enhancement, which was not previously applied?
I don't believe so. I think in that case, the government would have apparently made a strategic tack as to which enhancement to go for, would have submitted whatever evidence he believed he should submit to obtain that enhancement, and if he later proves to be wrong and have not submitted sufficient evidence, he can't later go back and change his course. That's kind of what happened here. The government, Mr. Noble objected to the sufficiency of the evidence of the Job quantity. In the face of that objection, the government chose not to call Mr. Job at the sentencing hearing. Now, had the trial court, following this court's remand, had the trial court followed either the plain language of this court's prior Noble decision, Noble 2, or followed the plain language of this court's Wick decision, or other similar decisions issued by this court, including United States versus Schneider, also authored by Justice Posner, as well as United States versus Sumner, there would be no need for the present appeal. But that didn't happen. The court, based on this court's finding in Wist, the government failed to carry its burden of proof, as this court specifically found in Noble 2. There was no waiver, there was no forfeiture, as again specifically found by this court in Noble 2. And it was specifically objected to. Under those circumstances, under which the government should not have been permitted a second chance at submitting evidence on this issue. But that's exactly what the district court did. And in the face of Mr. Noble's objection, the court allowed the testimony of Mr. Job to come back in at resentencing. Again, a decision the government specifically chose not to make at the original sentencing hearing, despite being faced with Mr. Noble's objection to the inclusion of the Job quantity. Ultimately, Mr. Job couldn't even support the original Job quantity at this resentencing hearing, and apparently the district court could get his confused and contradictory testimony to support was an amount slightly over half of that original estimate. That still results in as much as 7 years too much to Mr. Noble's sentence. Because the government bore the burdens of production and persuasion to support the inclusion of the Job quantity, and because the government had the full and fair opportunity to do just that, the government should not have been given a second chance. Were it any other way, the government's burden of proof wouldn't be much of a burden at all. Appeals based on insufficiency of the evidence would be meaningless. Court reversals based on those appeals would also be meaningless, and the government would simply continue to go back again and again, submit whatever evidence necessary to get that original enhancement or relevant conduct that they were shooting for. Now, this court's decision in Wish is not a unique decision. We've cited this court's decisions from the 3rd, the 4th, the 6th, the 8th, the 9th, the D.C. circuits. All are in accord. The government has presented this court with nothing. Nothing in this circuit, nothing from beyond. Contrary to the decision in U.S. v. Wiss.
Well, the government's argument is that Noble, at the first sentencing, never questioned the accuracy of Job's statement as, I guess, contained in the PSR. Isn't that their basic argument?
They have restructured their argument. It's now gone from Mr. Noble never objected to the sufficiency of the evidence. Now they've admitted that, in fact, he did. Now it's that Mr. Noble's counsel didn't object to the government's characterization of that insufficient evidence. But there's simply no support for that dancing on the head of a pin kind of argument. The only question that matters is, did Mr. Noble object to the sufficiency of the evidence supporting the Job quantity? If he did, and the government still chooses not to submit any additional evidence, the government cannot be heard later to complain. I see that I'm well into my rebuttal time. I would ask to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Griffiths. Mr. O'Shea?
Good morning, Your Honors. Tim O'Shea for the United States. The district court correctly heard the testimony of Mr. Jobe for essentially two reasons. First of all, the district court found that this court's opinion as a whole did not foreclose the court from hearing the testimony of Mr. Jobe. And the district court carefully considered the opinions of this court in Sumner and Wilson, and the district court contrasted that line of cases with the sort of somewhat competing line of cases relating to the unbundling of a sentence.
But why didn't Jobe testify in the first sentencing hearing?
Well, and that gets to the second point. The district court found as a factual matter that based on the court's own firsthand knowledge of what happened right in front of the court at the original sentencing, that the United States had no incentive to call Mr. Jobe at the first sentencing. The district court specifically found that at the first sentencing, it was Mr. Jobe's reliability that was in question. Mr. Griffiths has been on right. They always said, hey, this guy is unreliable. They challenged it, but as the district court found, that challenge did not relate to whether or not Mr. Jobe made the statement and whether it represented information provided to Mr. Jobe by the defendant.
I don't understand that. If you put the reliability of this out-of-court statement into question, then wouldn't it be natural for the government to call the state, the declarant, Jobe, so that the judge can assess his credibility?
Had Mr. Jobe not testified, Your Honor, over 2 days at the trial in this case, I would say yes. But the district court didn't need any more information to judge Mr. Jobe's reliability.
Then why did he testify at the second sentencing hearing?
The third sentencing hearing.
Because
same judge,
but now the question was different. Now the question was whether or not, as the district court find, whether Jobe made the statement.
That was not brought out during the trial?
No, it was.
So it's brand new material that's brought out in the third hearing.
It was information that was inaccurately paraphrased in the pre-sentence report.
So it's not brought out at any other hearing?
No.
Trial, first two whacks at it, or this time?
No.
So it's brand new.
As I said last time I was here, and Judge Posner asked, why didn't you just call Mr. Jobe for resentencing? I said, well, I thought this court had decided it, because the court had decided it in our favor. So there would have been no point in calling him the second time around. And I thought, well, what's the most fair thing to do? I mean, time has gone by. I mean, Mr. Jobe was not as good of a witness as for either side.
How long has the defendant been in jail now?
I want to say 4 years or so, Your Honor. And he's going to, regardless of what this court decides, he's going to be in jail for a long, long time, either way. Mm-hmm.
You say he testified at trial, and because testified at the trial, the judge could assess his credibility.
Generally, yes.
Then, and therefore could rely on the PSR. I'm lost now. I don't understand why he would be called at the third sentencing hearing.
Well, as it relates just generally to his credibility and reliability.
But the judge had already decided he was credible.
Right. But
what happened in between to take that?
Well, Mr. Noble got a new lawyer, Mr. Griffiths, and Mr. Griffiths realized that there was an inaccurate paraphrase in the pre-sentence report. And then we came back the second time to talk with you all, and you all decided, hey, look, that inaccurate paraphrase, it was wrong. There was nothing there for the court to rely on. And then the court provided a general remand.
Well, if there was nothing there, a remand for resentencing.
Right.
But they didn't say anything. I don't think we said anything about new hearing, obviously.
You didn't. Absolutely not. Sure.
Why not just take it as went back down, so you didn't have the evidence, sentence him as though it wasn't there?
Well, the district court, it was a general remand, and I...
Well, I thought it was a fairly specific remand.
Well, no, it's just remand for
resentencing. Yeah, remand for resentencing.
Right. But it was...
Because you failed to prove something that was necessary for the sentence that existed. So
right.
Send it back down for resentence.
Right. And I don't mean to interrupt you.
Finish with Judge Krasner.
Okay.
Well, you finished with me. Go ahead.
Okay.
Let the lady hit you a couple
yeah,
of times.
So what I'm trying to get at is, where do we draw the line? How many bites at the apple do you think that the government should get? This is not like the normal sort of clean slate scenario where an issue hasn't been raised at all and then we send it back. This isn't the typical unbundling type situation. I mean, where should we draw the line on the number of bites the government should get?
Right. I think it's fair to say that the government, that the court should look at it the way Judge Crabb looked at it, and as the court looked at it in Wilson, really, and say, well, did the government really have an incentive to call the witness, to present the evidence below? And if the court finds that the United States had the incentive in this case, fine, and then that's it. Now, the district court, I submit, correctly decided that the government did not have, based on the way she viewed the sentencing that happened right in front of her, that the government did not have that incentive at the first one. Now, and I think we should recognize that the Wythe case, even more so the Wilson case, is somewhat in tension with these unbundling cases in Noble last time around, and in Walker and Chu and all the rest of them. And the reason that is, and it's not so much of a big deal in this case, but you brought up like a guideline situation that could cause the whole thing to unbundle. Let's say the district, this court says, you know what, the defendant did not obstruct justice. Okay. Well, now if the guidelines, I think the guidelines make this sentencing package even more codified in a way. It does not diminish the whole unbundling idea, but it makes it stronger, and that is because the guidelines interlock with each other. Let's say in the obstruction of justice situation, the only reason for holding that the person didn't get an acceptance of responsibility was because of an obstruction. Well, they interlock with each other, and of course the defendant should be able to come back at a resentencing and say, hey, look, you know, I should get acceptance of responsibility. It shouldn't just be a two-point resentencing, but we should talk about whether it should be the additional 3 or 2 points for acceptance. So I think the unbundling thing, it's not as much of a big deal in this case, but I think it should, the crucial question, Your Honor, is whether or not the United States had an incentive to call the person the first go-around.
So do you think the same, if that's supposed to be the rule, would it apply to defendants as well?
Well, I think that'd be fact specific, but I think the United States generally has more of an incentive at sentencing because the government has to carry the burden of proof. So I think it should be more rigidly applied against the United States.
I understand your persistence. So as I understand it, Mr. Griffith is conceding that the bottom of his range would be 235 months, 20 years.
Long time.
Not enough. Is this some uniquely great gangster or something?
No, Your Honor. We in the Western District unusually hew to the idea of the guidelines and accountability under the guidelines, and we'll just keep doing it until we can do it as accurately as possible. It would have been entirely reasonable. If you're just looking at bottom line,
right.
just get it done. Compromise with the defense and get it done.
Right.
In the Western District, as the court knows, you see a lot of appeals out of the Western District because we don't have appeal waivers, because we don't say 10 kilograms is 5 kilograms. It's just not the way it works. It's not that he's such a bad guy, although I think he sort of is a bad guy, Mr. Noble, but not much worse than a lot of the other folks. It's just the persistent idea of accountability under the guidelines.
Well, I admire your persistence.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. O'Shea.
Thank
Mr.
you.
Mr. Griffith, how much time does he have? 1 minute?
Thank you.
Don't blow anything now.
Well, a couple points, and then I'll sit down. The government has fallen back on their claim at the last appeal that we only challenged the reliability of Mr. Jobe as opposed to the sufficiency of the evidence. Again, as this court found in Noble 2, that's specifically not true. We challenged both the reliability and the sufficiency, and this was the case was reversed because the evidence was insufficient supporting the Jobe inclusion. The government said that it had no incentive to call Mr. Jobe, but that's simply, again, not correct. In the face of a specific objection by Mr. Noble to the sufficiency of the evidence supporting the Jobe quantity, the government had a choice, either introduce more evidence or not. It ultimately chose not to introduce any more evidence at the sentencing hearing. It can't, now that its decision is proved wrong, it can't rewrite history and get a second bite at the apple. And finally, in response to Justice Williams' question about the...
Actually, you're a state court practitioner, aren't you?
Judge.
Because we're all judges. We're not justices. We don't want to take on errors. That's only in Washington.
I stand corrected. We are not asking for a broad rule. We're not asking for any new rule. We are simply asking to enforce the court's decisions in Wiss and Sumner, and as applied to this case, that requires that Mr. Noble should have been sentenced based on the record as it existed prior to Noble 2, with no new evidence at the second resentencing hearing, excluding any amounts on the Jobe quantity. And if I can have slight indulgence just to wrap it up here.
No, you already wrapped it up.
Okay, thank you.
Well, we have something vital.
Well, the last point I wanted to make is this is the third appeal. I would prefer to avoid a fourth appeal.
And not only us again. You don't want to see us again?
As honored as I am to make my third appearance here, I would prefer not to be back here on this case. As a result, I would ask that this court give a very specific... this court give a very specific instruction to the district court as to what the scope of the mandate is, so there's no further confusion. Mm-hmm. This sentence is vacated. And
be careful how you describe it.
I'll leave it to this court. I think they understand where I'm going.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Griffith. And, of course, you were appointed, were you not, throughout. So we thank you for your excellent efforts on behalf of your client. And we thank you, Mr. O'Shea. And we'll move on.